swung into view, swathed about its middle with those gleaming, brilliant rings. Wonderly's breath gushed out of her. "My God," she thought, "I can almost reach out and touch them."
"Still okay?" Gaeta asked.
"Those rings!" Out here she could see them clearly, even though they were more than 100,000 clicks away. Wonderly stared, awestruck. She could even see the narrow swaths of darker debris that swung through the glittering ice chunks of the rings, sooty dust from crumbled moonlets.
"Still okay?" Gaeta repeated, the strain clear in his voice.
"They're wonderful," she gasped. "So beautiful! Look at the way they're interwoven! They're gorgeous!"
"Don't lose your perspective," Gaeta snapped. "You're not out there to sightsee."
"Right," she replied, shaking her head inside the helmet. "It's just, they're so damned fascinating." Silence for several heartbeats. Then Gaeta said, in a considerably lighter tone,
"You're gonna get a lot closer to them, muchacha."
Titan Alpha. Following the dictates of its master program, Titan Alpha trundled across the frozen terrain, gathering data that would have made its human creators ecstatic with wonder and exultation. The biology program was busily storing data from its observations into Alpha's main memory core. The motile particles on the surface of the slushy, methane-covered ice were most likely living organisms, carbon-based units that metabolized the abundant hydrocarbons in the ice and the ethane-laced streams that fed into the distant seas. They were similar to the organisms detected in the seas by earlier probes, but there were significant differences as well. Using entirely passive observations, since active examinations were prohibited by the primary restriction, the biology program had deduced that the motile particles represented a low-temperature, psychrophile form of organism. Their internal metabolism was so slow, due to the low-temperature environment, that compared to Earth-normal biology, they could hardly be considered to be alive. Yet they were demonstrably ingesting nutrients from the hydrocarbons in the ice in which they lived. Their internal temperatures were noticeably higher than their external environment, and they gave off heat and waste matter, mostly gaseous methane, that quickly froze onto the ground. The very slowness of their metabolism was of significance, the biology program deduced. It could follow the organism's internal metabolic paths in exquisite detail, if only the primary restriction could be lifted. Where terrestrial organisms' basic metabolic reactions took place in hundreds of nanoseconds or less, these psychrophiles' reactions took tens of millions of nanoseconds to run to completion. A living slow-motion laboratory for the study of biology. Yet this promising avenue of study could not be pursued. The master program's primary restriction prohibited it. If the same conflict had existed among two human researchers, furious arguments and even violent struggle might have ensued. For Alpha's conflicting computer programs, however, there was no dispute, no quarrel. The program could not even feel regret that such an opportunity was being passed up. Indeed, the master program was examining another problem that it considered more important. The memory core was reaching its saturation point. Data was accumulating, but not being uplinked. The master program realized that once saturation had been reached, it must shut down all systems and enter hibernation mode until new commands were downlinked. The master program reviewed its options. It could uplink the stored data, but that was prohibited by the primary restriction. It could enter hibernation mode until new commands were downlinked. But the downlink antennas had been disabled to prevent any contradictions that would impinge on the primary restriction. It could erase all the accumulated data and continue to gather fresh data.
Of the three options, only the third did not result in violating the primary restriction.
16 February, 2096, evening. To his credit, Eberle spent several hours wrestling with his conscience, but as usual, he won. Sitting alone in his sparsely furnished apartment as the solar windows darkened into evening, he finally decided there was no other option. I've got to get rid of Holly. I can't have her working for me as a department head while she's running against me in the election. But it's got to be done carefully, he told himself. I can't just fire her. Everybody will see it as an out-and-out political move, a vendetta. I've got to be more delicate than that. He felt almost bad about his decision. He liked Holly on a personal level. She had always worked faithfully for him. But now she had turned on him, plunged a dagger into his back. It was her sister's doing, of course. Holly had been fine until Pancho had showed up. Pancho Lane was his real enemy. She was using Holly as a front, a dupe, a mask to hide her own ambition. And she's up to something more, he told himself. Pancho and Cardenas and that scientist Wonderly, they're scheming, cooking up some plot behind my back. I've got to find out what they're doing. Eberle straightened up in his recliner and called his computer to take a memo. One of the smart walls brightened, and as he spoke, his words appeared in print on the wall screen. Eberle dictated, corrected, rewrote his memorandum until he was completely satisfied with it. In the interests of efficient government and fair play, I hereby relieve Holly Lane of her position as Director of the Human Resources Department. Her decision to run as a candidate for Chief Administrator will require her full energies for the duration of the election campaign, and it would be unfair of me to demand that she fulfill her duties in the Human Resources Department while simultaneously running her political campaign. Therefore, I appoint the Deputy Director of Human Resources to assume the title and responsibilities of Acting Director of that department. Some may comment about Ms. Lane's sense of loyalty and duty, but I applaud her decision to offer a challenge for the office in which I have served the people of this habitat during its crucial initial months. Eberle reviewed his wording one final time, then nodded, satisfied. I'll send it to Berkowitz at midnight so he can use it on the morning news broadcast. I'm going to be making a major speech tomorrow evening. This will be the icing on that cake. Pleased with his work, he rose and headed for the cafeteria. More people ate there than in the habitat's two restaurants. More hands to shake, more voters to smile at. Let them see me as one of them, eating where they eat, sharing their lifestyle. As he headed down the corridor, smiling and nodding to the people he met along the way, he made a mental note to send a copy of the memorandum to Holly. Tomorrow, he thought, after the morning broadcast breaks the news, I'll send a copy to her home and another to her office, together with an order to vacate the office at once.
Urbain sat tensely at the central console in the Mission Control Center. 11 engineers bent over 11 other consoles, each of them showing the false-color imagery from one satellite's infrared camera view of Titan. Only a few more days of storage remain in Alpha's core memory, Urbain told himself for the 1,000th time. We must find her before she goes into hibernation mode. But even with 11 satellites crisscrossing Titan's smog-shrouded terrain in low polar orbits, finding Alpha was proving harder than he had imagined. In theory, the satellite's infrared cameras were capable of a 5-meter resolution, which should have been more than good enough to find the errant vehicle, but so far, no sight of Alpha. The special team he had assigned to building up a 3-dimensional view of Titan's surface was due to make its presentation to Urbain in the morning. Bah, he said to himself, pushing up from the console's wheelchair. I cannot wait. Time is flying by. He strode to his office and called the surveillance team. The phone computer tracked them down in a small workshop halfway across the habitat from Urbain's office. Dr. Urbain, said Daoud Habib, obviously surprised. In the phone screen, his lean, dark-eyed face looked thinner than Urbain remembered it, almost gaunt. The slim beard that traced his jawline had grown thicker, as if he had not trimmed it in weeks. Dr. Habib, Urbain replied, equally surprised.